This is Fresh Air, and I'm Terry Gross. My guest is Quentin Crisp, the effeminate British homosexual who became a cult figure after the publication of his autobiography, The Naked Civil Servant. The book was adapted into a film of the same name, starring John Hurt. Crisp came out in 1931. At a time when discretion was the rule for gays, Crisp thrived on exhibitionism. He grew his hair long and dyed it red, polished his nails, tweezed his eyebrows, and wore more lipstick and mascara than was considered proper for women of the time. Walking around the streets of London, he was insulted and mocked by strangers, harassed by police, and beaten by toughs. His overt effeminacy condemned him to a life in the margins of society. He writes, "My friends were anyone who would share my disgrace. My playground was any cafe from which I was not barred. My profession, any job that would have me." The job he held the longest was modeling nude for art classes, which is why he sometimes called himself the Naked Civil Servant. Quentin Crisp moved to Manhattan a few years ago. He's in his late 70s, and he's sure he would have never lived this long if he didn't know how to respond politely to the people who he outraged with his flamboyance. He offers that as his primary credential for his new book, Manners from Heaven, A Divine Guide to Good Behavior. To many gays, Crisp is a hero for having defied conventions and survived. Some gays are put off by his effeminacy, which they see as reinforcing a stereotype that they're trying to break. I asked Quentin Crisp why he chose to dress so outrageously when he came out instead of trying to blend in and pass for straight.
I think because I never really had a chance. There are, of course, a lot of homosexual men who look just like people, and they have to choose whether they will make any statement, either implicit or in actual words, about their sex life, or whether they will, as you say, try to pass. As I looked so helpless, so hopeless, and could not really find a way of joining the rest of the human race, and I'm speaking of a time, of course, long before I dyed my hair or plucked my eyebrows or lacquered my nails or any of that rubbish, I never really had a chance. I either had to make a terrible hash of being a real person, or else I had to try to be like myself as well as I knew how. So the problem was not really what I would do, but how I would cope with what I was stuck with. Because even at school, I was an object of comment. Why do you walk like that? Why do you speak like that? Why do you say this? Why do you do that? So that, of course, in the beginning, I did what nearly everybody does. I alternately confirmed and denied. One day I would try to behave like a schoolboy, thinking I can't bear all this persecution. Then the next day I would give that up, thinking it's all too humiliating. I will go on in the way that seems natural to me. Then the persecution was so great, I thought, no, I can't bear it. I'll go back to trying to be like a person. But by the time I left school altogether, I was nearly 18. And then I thought, well, it's hopeless. I will just be myself and try to endure the consequences. I knew they would be difficult. I didn't know how difficult they would be.
When you decided to be yourself,
yes.
You started dressing very extravagantly. How did you dress then when you were young?
Well, of course, by modern standards, my appearance wouldn't be remarkable at all. In New York, on 8th Street, which is called St. Mark's Place, there are people with half their hair green and the other half blue, or the other half shaved off altogether, with Fenimore Cooper hairdos. And they say to me things like, well, what was it? What happened? And if I say, well, I did henna my hair, they say, and then? Because they just can't imagine that anyone in New York would ever be persecuted for what they wore.
So what were you wearing that was as eye-catching and
well,
outstanding?
Well, for instance, I wore a velvet suit, And people came up to me in the street and fingered this suit, saying, "Where did you get this? And why do you wear this?" I wore sandals or even bare feet, and people would stamp on my toes. My hair was hennaed. But of course, as I say, by modern standards, the fact that I wore makeup, or that my eyebrows were plucked, or that my hair was dyed, and they mean nothing now, but they did then.
When you'd walk down the street, people would really notice you. You got beaten up a lot,
too. They would notice you, they would shout at you, they would throw things at you, they would push you around, they would come up and stand in front of you with their faces 1 inch from yours and say, "Who the hell do you think you are?" And of course, I didn't think I was anybody. I was only living a life which seemed to me to express my peculiarities, my personality.
You've said several times that you had a choice between being yourself or trying to look like a regular person or a human being. Did you feel like something less than a human being? Did you really believe in the inferiority of homosexuality?
I didn't really have any views in the beginning about homosexuality. My problem was never a sexual problem. It was a personality problem. I couldn't adopt all these mannerisms, these affectations, in a sense, that make you like a man. You see, at that time, and still to a large extent in England, you could have made a list of occupations, professions, clothes, gestures, words that were suitable for a man. And then you could have made another list of things which were suitable for a woman. And if you just move backwards and forwards, saying, "I don't really see that all these distinctions are necessary. I am in certain respects masculine. I am detached. I am unemotional. I am constant. And I don't think I have to explain that. But I am also physically weak, with tiny hands and feet, with a high voice. And I don't see why I should try and disguise this. This is simply the way I am."
When you first came out, what were the laws in England pertaining to homosexuality?
I think I'm right in saying that certain acts between men would have been illegal and you could easily go to jail. What most people went to jail for, the people I met when I was young, was, of course, soliciting prostitution. But then you could go into jail because you're a woman prostitute as well. But if you wore makeup or were effeminate, of course, it was assumed you were a prostitute, which, of course, is quite absurd. Nowadays, I don't think this assumption is made anymore. You might dress in a flamboyant way and be a rock star, or indeed just be enjoying yourself. You would still meet the hostility of the world, but you wouldn't, I think, be any longer assumed to be doing something illegal.
Were you frequently harassed by police?
Yes, all the time. The police do everything from just moving you on to giving you a fatherly lecture to, in the end, finally arresting me. And I was taken into custody, went to a police station. Someone had to bail me out. Then the following day, I was arraigned in a magistrate's court. But the evidence was considered to be insufficient to convict me.
Was there a cafe scene, a coffee house scene, or gay bars in the 30s in England, in London?
Certainly not known. No one would have known where to go unless they had friends who said, I'm coming to London, can you tell me of any gay cafes or gay bars? It was nothing like as open as it is now. And the cafes made up their mind whether to allow the gay people in and make the money while they could, and then expect the police to come when the place got outrageous or well known, or else they turned the gay people out on the first day. And this went on at one cafe or another in the heart of London all the time that I was young, that I was 19, 20, 21 or 2. There were people said, no, we don't go there anymore. We now go to such and such, such a place, because either the place has been broken to pieces by people who found out that it was a haunt of gay men, or else it's been shut by the police. And the same with the bars. A policeman could arrive and say to the proprietor, you run a funny sort of place. And if the proprietor said, why funny? They would have pointed to somebody like me and said, that kind of funny. And then the proprietor would have said, you can't come here again. They didn't care about me. They just wanted to keep their license.
You describe yourself as an effeminate gay. Does that mean that you ever wanted to be a woman?
I think if the operation, which is now so fashionable, had been available and I had had the enormous amount of money required, but if it had been offered to me before the age of 25, I would certainly have had the operation done, because it would have simplified my life. From that moment onward, I would have seemed perfectly explicable to the world. I could have gone away and lived in some distant suburb where no one had ever known me, and got a job in a wool shop, and just lived a perfectly ordinary life.
Did you model yourself at all on any women? I mean, were there women who you had in mind who...
I think almost all the effeminate gay men adopted the mannerisms of one movie star after another. And either they were trying to be like Miss Garbo or they were trying to be like Miss Dietrich. And the boys who were actually on the streets used to use female names and say their name was Greta or their name was Marlene or whatever it was, partly for fun, partly in self-mockery, but partly to live out this dream of being glamorous, being desirable.
You write about having this fantasy, a romantic fantasy, of a tall, strong, manly man falling in love with you, and the impossibility of that because, you know, a, quote, real man wouldn't fall for a homosexual.
Exactly. This exists and exists widely among effeminate homosexuals. It's a desire not to have to cope with life. You see, when I was young, all there was in the world was heterosexuality. That's all you ever saw. So you tended to live a pseudo-heterosexual life, and indeed to conduct your relationships with men in a pseudo-heterosexual way. You considered yourself to be the passive party. You considered yourself to be that which was pursued rather than the pursuer. And above all the women I knew when I was young, if you asked them why they got married, they said, oh, I got married to get away from home. The idea was that there would be some man who would take you away from all this, joined together with hyphens. You didn't know what they would take you to, or quite what you objected to about the life you had, except that, of course, you had to live it. And people like myself, who are ill-equipped to live, are constantly trying to place the responsibilities and the decisions in the hands of others. Now I have an agent, so it comes to the same thing. I never face any responsibilities.
So your agent takes care of that now instead of having to look for a lover to,
that's
to take
right.
that
you
over.
You don't need love anymore. You just need an agent.
A good agent.
That's right.
Did any of your straight friends ever try to convert you?
They did point out kindly the disadvantages of carrying on the way I did. Why do you go on like this? It's got nothing to do with other people. Live your own private life and try to get on in the outer world, which is a reasonable argument. But it would never have worked. I could have worn ordinary clothes. I could have had short hair. But my manner, my way of living, my ideas, they were all, to other people, far-fetched, peculiar.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Quentin Crisp, who is a writer, and he's the author of a very well-known autobiography called The Naked Civil Servant. Your image of yourself, I think, was very caught up in your appearance and how you looked. Did it trouble you when you started to age?
Yes, it troubles you when you first start to age. Round about in your late 30s, you think, well, one day my looks will no longer be a weapon. Funnily enough, when a program was on television about what people thought about old age, not one of the people questioned said, I regret the passing of my looks. And I found that extraordinary, because that's the first thing. You don't start to feel ill when you're getting to be 40. You hardly feel any different. You hardly even tire more easily. But you do know that your looks are no longer going to stop everybody dead for at least a few seconds, which they do when you're young, because they simply couldn't tell whether I was a man or a woman in my 20s. And this really did give them some pause. And, of course, later on this is not so. When I was 40, I stopped dyeing my hair red and started to dye it mauve, somewhat as it is now, so that people could see that my hair was dyed, but could not accuse me of dyeing it to look young. But, of course, by the time you're 50 or 60, you're old to the world. And it always amuses me that some famous actress will die, and then the news will be brought out that she wasn't really 92, she was 93. And you think, they've kept this weird secret all these years. And to a young person, if you said, no, actually, I'm not 60, I'm 70, they would say, oh, yes, because it's the same thing. There's no difference to young people. Anyone over 50 is one of them.
As you were hitting your 60s, I think it was probably about this time that the gay liberation movement was starting.
Well, yes, that did come into being in England, I suppose, about that time. And never as fiercely as in America.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, I want the activists, as I think they're called, I want them to have what they desire. And I know they want it for them, other people as well as for themselves. But in my opinion, politics make absolutely no difference to real life. I have, as I am now, over 70, I must have lived under 14 different governments without ever altering my way of living at all. A government has to be very extreme, in my opinion, before it makes any difference. If I had lived under a communist government, I would have been shocked. There's not the faintest doubt I would never have lived to be this age in Russia or China or Cuba. I would have been considered unproductive long before I'd been considered sinful, and I would have been got rid of in exactly the same way that Mr. Hitler got rid of all the people who were deviants of any kind.
But things that the gay movement has gotten besides voting booth politics is that there are more gay bars, there are gay bookstores, there are gay restaurants, there are places to shop, places to eat, places to meet other people in a religious setting as well as in a dance setting.
Yeah.
Do you ever wish that you had something like that when you were young and you were getting ostracized?
Well, if there had been a place to which I could have gone at the age of 19 or 20, where the one thing that worried everybody else would be the one thing that was accepted, I wouldn't have had to explain myself in any way, then I would have run all the way. I would have been sitting on the doorstep before it opened. But, you see, this is not what happened. Gay, politically gay people are against the flimsy, unproductive, frivolous element in the gay community. And there are bars in America where it says, please do not wear this, that, and the other. Do not wear cologne of any kind. And say, well, I mean, this is more discrimination.
Do you think that even with the advent of the gay liberation movement that effeminate gays have still been kept out and criticized?
I think they will always be despised by the world and by a certain kind of gay man whose problem is more sexual freedom rather than more freedom to express your personality.
Why did you move from England to New York? How long has it been?
Well, I first came here for a few days in 1977. And I came because I was invited. I could never have paid my fare to America. I have never earned, as regular wages, more than £12 a week. That's $25 in a good year. So I would have been saving up for 3 years to spend 3 days in America. But when I was invited, I came here. And the moment I saw New York, I wanted it. But that's not surprising because I've always been American in my heart. And the moment I saw the movies, I wished I lived in America.
You've lived a very bohemian life. Have you in any way become more conservative with age in terms of, you know, your lifestyle, your apartment, anything like that?
Well, I don't think so. I live in New York in the same way that I lived in London, in one room, in a rooming house. And I lived in England for over 40 years, in one room, in a rooming house. So that I don't think my life has grown any different. I would say my appearance is more moderate. But that would have happened merely by growing older, I think.
You've lived alone nearly all of your life.
Yes.
And you once referred to your home as your dressing room, like you like to go home, go back to your dressing
room.
Yes,
that's right. Because my life is lived so consciously in the world, whereas another person can just go out and buy some milk and come back again. I can't really do this because I expect that people may speak to me and talk to me and ask me why I buy milk or whatever. So that I am with the world every minute that I'm out of the door. I'm prepared to be with the world every minute I'm out of doors. My behavior, therefore, is always circumspect out of doors. When I get home, there has to be some time when I do absolutely nothing. And now, because I am older and I tire more easily, I try to have at least one day a week in which I never leave my room, so that I don't reconstruct myself, pull myself together, go out in that conscious way.
Do you see life as theatre?
I see my life, yes, as theatre. And of course, in this I am aided and abetted by New Yorkers, because there never has been a city which was so totally given over to the big time as New York. Everybody is a secret actor.
You've said that to survive your life was an adventure and to reach old age was a miracle. Do you ever look back and think about people who are probably not with us any longer, who I'm sure warned you that the life that you're living was a dangerous life and that you'd get yourself into all kinds of trouble and you wouldn't live very long, you'd die of venereal disease or get beaten up in the streets. And here you are nearing 80, looking terrific. I mean, do you ever...
I am reminded of that. The other day, I can't think what did remind me, but I said I can remember that someone said, not behind my back, but to my face, "You'll never live through another winter." And I was about 24 then. But of course, I was very frail. The thing is, people mistake a vast physique for a good constitution. They're in no way connected. When younger, I seemed to have an invincible constitution. I just survived.
That was Quentin Crisp, my guest on this edition of Fresh Air. Crisp's autobiography, The Naked Civil Servant, is published by New American Library. The film based on the book is available on home video cassette. Quentin Crisp's new book, Manners from Heaven, is published by Harper & Row. Fresh Air is a production of WHYY Radio in Philadelphia. The engineer for this edition was Joyce Lieberman. Fresh Air is edited by Maeve McGoran. Amy Salad is the associate producer. Danny Miller and I co-produce the show. My name's Terry Gross, and I want to thank you for listening.
This edition of Fresh Air is available on cassette. To order a cassette of this interview or for a listing of other Fresh Air programs available on cassette, call toll-free 800-253-0808. In Alaska and Wisconsin, call 608-263-4892. The number again for a cassette of Fresh Air is 800-253-0808. National distribution of Fresh Air is made possible with the financial support of listeners to WHYY-FM, Philadelphia. Additional funding comes from National Public Radio member stations and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.